for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama heads off to Western states for more town hall meetings and to counter what he calls myths about health care plans. A coalition of groups backing an overhaul launched a $12 million TV ad campaign. The Fed says the economy is leveling off, but new reports show tough times are not over yet. And former Vice President Cheney's memoir is expected to detail his clashes with President Bush. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, Jackie Combs of The New York Times, Matthew Continetti of The Weekly Standard, and Eleanor Clift of Newsweek. We do invite your calls, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Jackie Combs, what's going on at these town hall meetings?
Well, it depends on which one you go to, sort of. After the initial news coverage, exhaustive coverage of the town hall meetings at which the opponents of health care reform dominated the coverage, the Democratic National Committee and the It's Organizing for America, which is sort of the continuation of the Obama grassroots network, has weighed in and made sure that proponents of health care reform are at meetings. And so the DNC has begun distributing a number of videos of that, again, are getting picked up, like the more hostile meetings did, of a very civil, polite meeting. So it's clear the word has gone out that be there and be quiet.
Matthew, is this a vocal minority or something much, much bigger?
Well, I think the people vocalizing are probably in the minority, but with the fact is that they represent plurality of public opinion. I mean, Barack Obama's approval rating on the healthcare issue, according to Gallup, below 50%. Polls in the Wall Street Journal last week, the New York Times, or rather 2 weeks ago, showed that approval for the healthcare reform is not a majority position in the country. And we see from the Gallup poll this week that, in fact, since the protests began, we find, while most people haven't changed their opinion, 34% have found that the protests have made them more sympathetic to what the vocalizers are saying.
Eleanor Clift, how much of these protests are actually organized? How much of them are spontaneous?
Well, I think that there are people who are opposed to the president's plan, even though they don't know what it is and it doesn't really even exist. And I think they're revved up really by a right-wing media network that's pretty powerful. And I think there are some public relations and public lobbying firms that are behind it. But they're having an impact because independents, the key group that each side wants to win over, are looking at these protests and thinking they represent, you know, a building revolution among the American people, against this supposed government takeover. And I think the president, the White House, they've been slow in reacting. I think now ads are getting up. The president is out there. He's going to have another town meeting today in Bozeman, Montana, which is the home state of the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And I think the sort of outrageous behavior of some of the protesters with swastikas and comparing the president to Hitler and really has the potential of creating a backlash and getting the sort of, if you will, the silent majority revved up as well, because this is, at some point, it's going to be, yes, do you want this health care? No, do you want it? It'll be a cleaner decision.
2 points to make. Bloomberg News is reporting there are more than 3,300 lobbyists registered to lobby on health care reform, roughly 6 lobbyists for every sitting member of Congress. That's really quite remarkable. Secondly, I You talk about people using swastikas and calling President Obama Hitler. You heard Senator Chuck Grassley saying we should not have a government program that determines if you're going to pull the plug on grandma. But earlier this week, I referred to Nancy Pelosi calling healthcare critics un-American. In fact, Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer wrote a USA Today opinion piece titled Un-American. And what they wrote was, drowning out opposing views is simply un-American. Drowning out the facts is how we failed at this task for decades. Nancy Pelosi did not say the opponents themselves were un-American. So everybody's getting into the debate, Matthew.
That's right. Harry Reid, calling some of the protesters evil mongers just in the past 24 hours, I thought it's a funny coinage. Let's take a step back.
Hold on. Tell me why that's funny when you're talking about killing off grandmas and Sarah Palin talking about the fact that her Down syndrome child might have been killed off.
Right. Well, what he's conflating a minority of people using exaggeration and hyperbole with the majority of people who have serious concerns about the program. And that conflation, I think, will come back to hurt the Democrats if they continue with this. But the larger question is that the political problem for Obama right now is he's spending all of his time explaining what isn't in his bill. It'd be like an author explaining the plot of Moby Dick by saying, well, it's not about Hester Prynne being accused of adultery, and it's not about Yossarian being stuck in the hospital ward. You never get around to the actual plot of the bill, and so you can't convince people to buy your novel.
Jackie.
Well, I'm, I don't know about un-American, but it's certainly discourteous at a minimum the way some of the people have been behaving at this. And I talk to people. It's my job to talk to people on both sides of a question. And this is a very complex area. And when you have people, when you're resorting to talking about whether or not there's death panels in this, I mean, I don't go so far as to call it a lie because some people. Read reputable publications and think they have reason to believe that. But I think there are people that know better that are lying about it. And, and I respect Senator Grassley of Iowa very much. I've covered him for a quarter century. But yesterday he announced that they were going to drop or that they were not even going to have a provision in their health care bill that is the one that's in question when it comes to death panels, which is that Medicare should provide assistance every 5 years if the beneficiary wants it to get counseled by their physician or some professional about living wills, how much care they want if once they're at the end of life and can no longer voice their opinions.
In order, the bottom line is there to pay for it.
Right. And, physicians think they should be compensated for their time. Well, Senator Grassley put out this statement from his Washington office yesterday saying that this was not going to be in the Senate bill that he's hoping to negotiate with the Democrats because it's, as he put it, this isn't a direct quote, but as he put it, it was too open to misinterpretation. And the day before, he had been at his own town meeting in Iowa at which he said the quote that you mentioned earlier about we don't want a bill that's going to pull the plug on grandma. Now, there's a real disconnect there between, decrying something for being misinterpreted, but then contributing to the misinterpretation.
Well, it's willful misinterpretation. And you are, Jackie, the co-author of a front page piece in the New York Times today, basically tracing how this rumor, if you will, got started. And it began with Betsy McCoy, who is a conservative activist in New York, who was a lieutenant governor, I think, on the Republican slate. And so she brings some credibility to her conversation. And she was on a talk show hosted by Bill Bennett. And she made this comment about that people would be forced to come up with a plan for how they're going to die every 5 years and that this was mandatory. And it took off from there, and everybody just glommed onto it and willfully ignored the facts. Now, end-of-life issues are sensitive, and you have a very activist, again, I think minority in this country, that were behind the whole uproar around Terri Schiavo, and that was an end-of-life issue now 4 years ago, and whether she could be allowed to die and have her feeding tube disconnected. And end-of-life issues are now conflated with the abortion issue, and so there's a lot of sensitivity around it. And I understand the sensitivity, and I think they're pulling the plug on the clause in the bill because it comes under the heading of it's more trouble than it's worth. And you're going to now count on doctors to raise these conversations under in visits that are otherwise compensated so that wouldn't be a separate visit, I guess.
And Diane, Eleanor has personally lived through these end-of-life issues in her family, and that is also true of many members of Congress who are behind this particular provision, and it is a bipartisan provision. For that very reason, that Republicans as well as Democrats have dealt with these end-of-life issues for their loved ones.
But is that the central issue here, or is it the money around a health care overhaul? Is it President Obama himself?
Well, I think, though, it actually speaks to one of the central issues, which is the level of decision-making, right? And I think what repulsed people with this rumor of the death panels that galvanized public opinion, certainly, no matter its truth content, was that they didn't want the federal government incentivizing these conversations. They'd much rather it occur on a private level. And I think that's a larger debate about healthcare. They don't want this centralized takeover of the system.
Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. He edits the magazine's Campaign Standard blog. Short break. We'll be right back. Here's an interesting question from Mary on Facebook. She says, has anyone figured out what is driving the misinformation engine? Some people have been frightened out of their good sense, obviously. How? Why? Who stands to lose if reform is finally realized? Eleanor.
Well, I think there are two camps. One politically, and I think some Republicans have been pretty upfront about the fact that if you deny President Obama this victory, political victory, that it cripples his presidency and it creates the foundation for a conservative Republican comeback. So there's political incentive. And then there's incentive on the part of various special interests who are making money off of the current system and are threatened by any change, even if they might do well under a reformed system. They don't want to risk it. And then thirdly, I think people who have health insurance and worry that under an expanded system, they can only lose. And I think they become sort of part of the chorus line for the other two groups.
Well, this gets back to what should be the central question of the debate, too. Who stands to lose? The question goes as well or even more to the who stands to lose if there is no health care reform. I'm not saying this as an endorsement of any particular plan, but as it stands, the costs, unsustainably rising costs of health care for the private sector and the government are are crowding out everything else. By the middle of this century, the cost for Medicare and Medicaid will drive out, will exceed. There will be no room left in the budget, given the revenues coming in, to pay for any other function of government. None. And so this has to, something has to be done. And, you know, a lot of the major industries, you mentioned 3,000 lobbyists have registered.
3,300.
Well, all right. And it's probably rising. But the fact is that this is one-sixth of the economy, and the private industry knows this time, as they did not in the 90s, that, you know, something has to be done because it can't be sustained.
Matthew, has President Obama lost control of this debate?
Oh, I think it's clear he did. And as Charles Krauthammer points out this morning in the Washington Post, he did around mid-June, which is when the CBO started its fusillade against the cost projections, saying that actually these bills would add to the deficit despite the administration's claims. And this series of CBO reports that have come out of the summer have kind of coincided with the drop, if you follow the graph on pollster.com, coincided with the drop in Obama's job approval rating. So now he's going to try to get it back, and that's why he's in Montana today. He's going to Colorado tomorrow. He spent earlier in the week in New Hampshire trying to combat the misinformation. But I, again, every time you're explaining in politics, it means you're in a corner. And I think to reassert himself, he's going to have to go back to the fundamentals, maybe retrain it on the insurance companies like he's been trying to do, but also maybe say, just put forward the liberal goal of universal coverage despite the cost.
I want to get to you, Eltner, on that, but someone has called to chastise me on the Grassley quote. I'm going to read you that quote in full. Senator Grassley said, "There is some fear because in the House bill there is counseling for end of life, and from that standpoint you have every right to fear. You shouldn't have counseling at the end of life. You ought to have counseling 20 years before you're going to die. You ought to plan these things out. And I don't have any problem with things like living wills, but they ought to be done within the family. We should not have a government program that determines if you're going to pull the plug on grandma."
Well, one thing that's wrong about what he said is this isn't to provide assistance for people at the end of their life. It's to provide assistance before they get to the end of their life. There's a welcome to Medicare exam that beneficiaries get, at which it's already the law that they it is an option to be covered, that seniors, 65-year-old people can get government. Medicare will cover the cost of getting counseling about a living will, power of attorney, all those things that you want to make decisions about while you're still able. And then what this provision in the House bill, I'm not endorsing it or opposing it. I'm just saying every 5 years after that, if you want, you can have that and know that Medicare will cover it.
All right.
Plus the fact you can have this consultation with your physician and say, if something happens to me, I want to be kept on tubes and a respirator.
Absolutely.
And I want to be frozen until I'm 300. It doesn't mean that you have to say that you don't want more treatment. So it really has been extraordinarily distorted. And you can't enter a hospital these days without being asked whether you have an advance directive. That was legislation that went through Congress in 1991. Senator Danforth, a prominent Republican and an Episcopal priest, was a major co-sponsor that legislation. It was totally non-controversial. So this has been seized on for political purposes. And I actually think the political opponents this time are stronger than the special interests, because the president really has co-opted the pharmaceuticals, the hospitals, the AMA is supporting him. So if some of these other interests begin now to join the fight to support health care reform, I think the contours of this debate could change significantly.
But Eltner, people are saying that President Obama has lost control of the debate so far.
The momentum is on the wrong side. He has lost, but I think he can regain it in part because of the tactics of the other side.
You know, sometimes when we're having this debate, I get flashback into the spring and summer of 2005. The president's different. Again, it's a major plan dealing with entitlements. With Bush, it was Social Security. And again, there, the president let Congress take the lead, just as Obama has done with health care. And what President Bush found was that since he didn't have kind of a bedrock thing to say, this is the plan, this is my proposal, this is what I want to do, instead you had all these other proposals floating out there that the critics would pick through and take different items from and exaggerate and distort. The president lost control of that debate. The same way Obama's losing control of this one.
I thought the president had a very simple message then. It was just that it didn't make sense to a lot of people. And given what's happened to the stock market, God bless the Congress
for having
stopped that one.
Another similarity is people don't like these large-scale changes in what they're used to. And the fact is most Americans are covered by their employers, and most Americans who are uncovered by their employers are satisfied with their coverage.
But he's already said, if you're satisfied with your health coverage, fine.
He also said he'd guarantee the warranties on everyone's GM cars, but I think there are a lot of consumers who are finding that that's not the case.
I don't think that people who have insurance today understand the fragility of the system. They see their copayments going up. They know they could be dropped for a pre-existing condition or an illness the insurance company doesn't want to cover. So the notion that you have this free access and everything is fine and nobody's telling you can't have anything is a total false depiction of the way the medical system operates. I mean, I think the people who are saying this have never really been sick.
So, Jackie, what is the president intending to do to take this back?
Well, I think what he's intending to do is, first of all, have his network and his operation do a better job of confronting the misinformation. You're seeing that, put that in place now. But for himself, he has to do something that he really thought he had taken care of, and that is to convince the overwhelming number of Americans who already have insurance that there is something in it for them, that there's something in it for reform for them. All through his campaign, unlike Bill Clinton in 1992 or his Democratic rivals, including Hillary Clinton in 2008, he emphasized cutting costs for everybody over universal coverage. He never even promised universal coverage except for children. And in that way, he had hoped that this would be seen as a benefit for everyone, insured and uninsured. What happened is, as Matthew referred to the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office's estimates earlier this summer, which showed that the bills taking shape in Congress were costing more than he wanted. As an aside, I'll say President Clinton, President Obama, had his separate ways of paying for this that Congress had rejected. So what CBO was measuring was Congress's plans. At that point, you know, just as in the 90s with Clinton, the public says, well, I've got my insurance, and it may not be perfect, but I've got it. And so what is this cost for? And the answer is it's mostly for expanding Medicaid and for providing subsidies to working poor people to get insurance and to small employers to cover their employees. In other words, most of the costs are for covering the uninsured. So then people say, well, I don't want to pay those costs. I've got my insurance. Let them fend for themselves. And that's where he is now, and he has to get back to making the case. And I'm not sure it can be made adequately, but he's got to make the case that there's something in this for the insured Americans.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's the constituency he lost, is people who have insurance. It may not be perfect, but they don't want to risk losing something to benefit somebody else. But we're in the middle of the sausage factory, and even those CBO estimates, while they started out very high, have come down kind of spurred the Congress to come up with different plans and, you know, taxes and levies and all that. It's unpleasant stuff. So they're going to wait till the very last minute for all of that. And so I think the fact that there isn't a clear bill that the president can defend and promote, and yet there are all these targets of opportunity for the opponents, has created an uneven fight.
I think the operative question is, are the chances for reform going to be higher at the end of this congressional recess than they were at the beginning? And the way that the recess is playing out, I think the answer is no. I think the chances are going to be substantially less coming out of this August than they were going in.
Do you agree with that?
I don't agree, because if the Democratic-controlled Congress lets this moment slip away, they will pay a huge price in the elections next year for not delivering. And I do think it would.
And how will they deliver, Eleanor?
Well, we may not get the full blown public option. Oh, maybe there'll be some this co-op idea, or maybe there'll be some trigger mechanism that if the insurance companies don't shape up, they will get something. At a minimum, they will get insurance reform that you can't. Cut people off for pre-existing conditions. They will get something. Now, whether liberals will be happy with it, probably not entirely. Whether conservatives will be screaming it's a socialist takeover, no matter what it is. Because, also I think the political opposition is also an effort to delegitimize this presidency because it's happening against the backdrop of the birthers movement, is this president really, was he legitimately born in this country? I mean, I think a lot of the borderline racist attitudes that were kept under wraps during the campaign have erupted in the context of this health care reform.
Eleanor Clift of Newsweek at 27 before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And believe it or not, there was other news besides healthcare this week. The Federal Reserve Board said the economic decline is leveling out. Matthew, what does that mean for us?
Well, it means we may be technically out of the recession. We'll have to see what happens. And we had some moderating data, unemployment now at 9.4% rather than that ugly 9.5. But what it means, though, I'm actually going to take a contrarian view. I think the improving economy may pose, believe it or not, a political problem for Obama. And I'll say why. One is that the stimulus, most of the money for the stimulus has not been spent. And you see a growing effort among conservative Republicans to say, well, listen, if we're coming out of this economic crisis, the economy is recovering, why spend the rest of the stimulus money that's going to add to the deficit?
Jackie.
You would be hard-pressed, and I would challenge someone to find an economist in this country who, and not just liberals, who would think that would be the way to go. That the money, the stimulus, was always intended as a 2-year plan, as sort of a time release capsule. Because I'm a big skeptic of stimulus bills overall. They're generally, once they get through the process, they're too little, too late. In this case, the downturn was so severe that it was generally agreed, even by a number of conservatives I talked to, that this was the right way to go. Even just the anticipation. I was on a panel yesterday with a Bush administration veteran who said that just the anticipation of this coming changes behavior, both for state and local governments. That is, they don't cut as many people off their payrolls as they would otherwise, and for business who anticipate getting some of this money, like a company in Indiana where President Obama was last week when I was on that trip, that they bought a failed company because in anticipation that stimulus help would help the economy and help it in particular. A lot of these things are coming out, are in the pipeline, and are, if you were to come back and retrench now, it would be like the mistakes made in 1937 when Franklin Roosevelt retrenched before the Depression was really over.
And what about cash for clunkers, Eleanor? How well has that worked, and is it stimulating not only sales, right, but production?
The car lots are emptying out of fuel-efficient cars, and now the administration is saying they will honor the rebate even if people order directly from the factory. So I think it's been a great economic booster shot. And what's important about it is people can see it. I mean, and Joe Sixpack gets to take advantage of it. I'm sure there are some, people who could afford to buy a new car who also got caught up in it, but I think for the most part it's been a terrific idea.
Matthew, what have you heard about former Vice President Cheney's new memoir?
Well, I don't think much more than anyone else here who has. I think we're expecting it in 2011. Barton Gellman had that great piece in the Washington Post this week talking about the vice president's writing process. He's going to have some disputes with George W. Bush, primarily about the conduct of foreign policy in the president's second term, in which the main player was no longer Vice President Cheney as it had been in the first term, but it was Condoleezza Rice, who really did take the lead on Bush foreign policy in the second term and led to a lot of policy judgments that the vice president disagrees with, and actually many policy judgments which are being more or less continued by the present administration.
It's certainly interesting that in the past, Vice President Cheney has been so contemptuous of other books
of
written.
Kiss and tell books, exactly. Right. And he's the master of secrecy, except when it's in his own interest to speak out. And we could have the dueling memoirs here because, you know, President Bush is also working on his, recreating, I think, his 10 most important decisions. He may feel compelled to answer some of the vice president's criticisms. I would argue that the second Bush term was much more internationalist, much more dependent on diplomacy than the first term, trying to actually, from my perspective, to make up for the ground that was lost in the first term.
Eleanor Clift, Matthew Continetti, Jackie Combs. We'll take a short break. When we come back, it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Secretary of State Clinton decries the sexual violence in eastern Congo. The Taliban in Afghanistan threatens to harm anyone participating in next week's presidential election and signs the recession is easing in Europe. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. This hour, we'll deal with domestic issues. First to New Haven, Connecticut. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Morning. I recognize there are press outlets that are not in the truth business, but those that are, such as Newsweek and the New York Times, I think are doing a very poor job in this health care debate and generally. You know, when there's a lie in the truth, they seem to think that objectivity requires that they split the difference. And I think it would be more of a service to the public if they would call a lie a lie.
Jim, did you by any chance see this morning's New York Times front page?
I was going to mention that they are now making some fumbling efforts in that direction, but 2 weeks ago, a month ago, put it in the headline, John Boehner is lying about the health care plan.
All right. Is that something you would agree with, Ilner?
Well, I do think that the mainstream media does feel constrained to offer both sides of the issue. And even when all of the evidence is on one side, they're presented in kind of an equal and partial way. And
as
they're
though
reluctant.
Saying the Holocaust didn't happen in equal terms.
Some people say.
Yeah, right.
And then you have to go to the editorial pages, and then a lot of people think the editorial pages are biased. And, you know, sometimes lies are lies, and I think we shouldn't be afraid to say that, use that word.
Jackie?
Well, this is a debate that's been going on as long as I've been in journalism and will continue to. When you're in the main, would I like to call the death plans talk a lie? I would, for the most part. But unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who are good people who pick up on this, and they see folks who are in positions of authority, whether it's Sarah Palin, although she's quit her position of authority, John Boehner and others, and they think, well, if, you know, smart, accomplished people believe that, then why shouldn't I? And so, I mean, lie is such a fraught term that, you know, it's just very hard to go there.
Matthew?
Well, a lie is a subjective judgment. It may be accurate one, but it is a subjective judgment. People can disagree about what is a lie, and lies also get to people's motives.
But
and
that's sort
the press
of relativism.
Still has,
how well, about falsehood? I mean, falsehood is
look,
a good word.
The press still has a pretense to objectivity, and therefore, rather than stick the word falsehood or lie in a headline, they're going to have to explain why it might be one subtly. But, they'll have to subtly explain why it might be a falsehood. But I think actually we see that pretense to objectivity is breaking down, and more we have, you know, direct, unmediated journalism, factcheck.org, from blogs, from radio, whatever. I mean, there an upside to that is that the facts can be disputed very quickly. A downside is that people tend to visit those news sources that they already agree with.
All right, to Henry in Margate, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Are we forgetting that for 8 years, the most inept president in the history of this country went about running this country into the ground? And secondly, just how did the Republicans pay for this stupid war in Iraq? And how did they pay for that prescription drug reform? And now that they are carping about the deficit that Barack Obama has to spend money in order to get us out of the Republican mess that they left us?
Jackie.
Well, the caller reminds me of one fact that I would like to throw into this. And the Medicare prescription drug bill, for which there was never any attempt to offset its costs over time, will projections now show that in the next 10 years, which is the same time period that we're trying to offset the costs of health care reform and roughly $1 trillion, give or take a few hundred billion, that prescription drug benefit will add $803 billion to the debt over the next 10 years, nearly as much, 80% of the way to the goal for offsetting health care. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. It's just health care reform does have to be offset. But the cost, it can't just be cost that or savings and taxes that are do nothing to bring down the rising costs of health care. So I applaud the administration for trying to offset the costs, but the offsets do – we have to wait and see whether they're going to truly be offsets that bring health care costs under rein.
Well, the Republicans are guilty of stunning hypocrisy, but, you know, that's not really new in politics, and they're counting on the American public to have short memories.
I also don't think we should confuse kind of this grassroots Tea Party, anti-health care town hall crowd, necessarily confuse them with the Republican Party as it exists here in Washington, D.C., or in its official capacities. I think a lot of the same people who are going against Obama right now, whether it's on the stimulus or health care, would probably also have been against the prescription drug bill in 2003 and even maybe the Iraq War, at least once the Iraq War turned south in 2006. This is a constituency that could easily be viewed to have voted for Ross Perot in 1992 or to vote prospectively for another third-party anti-deficit, Washington candidate in the future.
Which is to say they are a minority of a minority, and right. Yet they are dominating the debate.
And
that says
fact,
something about the media,
right.
Too.
In fairness to Republicans, a lot of them are LaRouche followers, too. It's plain at these town hall meetings. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Oh, they're openly the
They're
signs.
The ones with the swastikas.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Let's go to Tim in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm sorry. I can't really let the press get off the hook on this, on this conversation you've been having about the misinformation, because I think the press is really the source of a lot of this misinformation, because people like Betsy McCaughey, who is the former attorney, lieutenant governor of New York, is really the source of a lot of this misleading claims and lies, if you want to call them. She's a one-person hit squad on creating a lot of these lies that then become sources for things like these death panels. And another, to cite one immediate example, one of your panelists today from the Weekly Standard made the comment that there's a government takeover of healthcare. He said that right before the break today. And, frankly, that's just not true. This plan is not a government takeover of healthcare. At the core, it's going to be creating health exchanges, which is private health insurance. It's not government insurance. It's not a socialized medicine. Comments like this are just wrong.
All right, Tim, I do want to refer you to this morning's front page of the New York Times, where Jackie Combs, our guest this morning, did a long piece on precisely what you're talking about, the beginnings of these myths about the death panels. Matthew.
Right. Well, the bills, in as much as they impose federal control over the entire health insurance system, right? Right now we have, they replace federal mandates with state mandates and such. That would be takeover, if you want to call it, or the imposition of federal control over the nationwide insurance market. Secondly, the House bill includes the public option, and what the main opposition to the public option is it's believed to be a Trojan horse down the line for a national health care system, right? I mean, this is an argument that we're trying to anticipate the unintended consequences of a public option that would price out the private insurance companies altogether.
The public option would be a Medicare-like program for people who are under 65. Anybody who has Medicare goes to their own doctor. You have your choice of doctor. Just the government is paying some of the bills, and it gets taken out of your Social Security check. It's not like you're going to see government doctors, and people are happy with Medicare. Secondly, Howard Dean, who is a physician and a liberal, answered this question about whether the public plan is a Trojan horse to get to a single payer. You would think maybe he's a liberal, is he for single payer? He says no. He's for a hybrid system, which is essentially very American, keeping all the insurance companies in the picture, and because the government does a good job, and if it were a totally single payer plan, it would be more efficient. But you get innovation from the private system. He says he supports the innovation. The insurance companies are going to have plenty to do. They're not getting out of the picture.
And plenty of money to make.
And plenty of money to make.
Jackie.
I would also agree that it's just false to call this a government takeover of healthcare, in the sense that, the American Medical Association, for instance, would not be endorsing this effort if that's what
it was. But they haven't endorsed. They have endorsed
the effort.
That's what they have not endorsed.
There is
a plan,
right. And a lot of these groups that are currently on board with the Obama administration, it's tentatively on board. And they're on board to see what comes out of the conference committee of the House and Senate. They would not be for the House bill. They're waiting to see what's going to come out of the Senate. But one thing I would like to add, first of all, the public option, what often gets lost is if there is one, it's going to be self-sustaining after an initial infusion of government money. That's the plan, at least. Whether it is or not, you could argue, but we don't have a crystal ball. Also, when you count the number of Americans in this country who already have government-run health care, which is Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, public employees, and the children's health insurance program in the state and federal programs, that's more than a third of the country and rising.
All right. To Indianapolis. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Diane. I would like to share some thoughts. I'm an American physician, and I had the good fortune of working in Canada for 2 years as a consultant in practice of medicine. And I can tell you that it is a fine system. And I'm very concerned with how the Canadian healthcare system is being portrayed by various groups in this country. I'm also would like to share that in the time I was in Canada, in this clinic, I never had to deal with provincial authorities about any question with patient care whatsoever, unlike insurance companies in the United States. There was no rationing of care for the patients I took care of, and I actually, as a physician, received virtually 100% of the fees billed to the provincial authorities. And I really would like to see you and others begin to provide a more honest portrayal of the Canadian healthcare system. I have about 30 friends in Canada I visited just recently, and not one of them would trade their system for the American system.
I think that's a great idea for a front page story, to truly take a very clear look at the Canadian system. Now, John in Indianapolis thinks it works great. We've heard from others who have other views.
Look, you could find horror stories in every system, but the fact is the single payer is off the table because it's not politically possible in this country. I think Senator Obama said at one point that if we were starting over, he would be for a single payer plan, and that he's been quoted saying that. But we're not starting over, and so I think the insurance companies are here to stay. Their worry is that the public plan could be so successful that eventually they may be driven out of business.
Jackie,
that's a long time away.
If I could give a plug to NPR, I think it was just yesterday, they did a really nice report out of Canada. You know, it was both sides, but generally said what your caller just said.
That's very interesting. One last question here, and it's about Karl Rove. Illner, could the documents that were released on Tuesday by the House Judiciary Committee help prosecutors bring charges against him in the White House firings of U.S. attorney?
The notes show much deeper and earlier involvement than he has owned up to. But frankly, I don't sense a political appetite in the Justice Department to go after Karl Rove. I mean, I think they're still debating whether they're going to go after people who went outside the bounds and tortured people. And I think that's still up in the air.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Raleigh, North Carolina, Jackie, you've been waiting a long time. You're on the air.
Thank you so much, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
I look forward to your Friday roundup, and I'm very glad to be on. I just wanted to ask, everybody's talking about this government rationing of health care, and people don't realize that our insurance companies now are rationing care. I have great health care, private health care, but there are times when they tell me I can't do this, or they even tell you what doctors you can see. You have to pick doctors within their network. I don't see why everybody's getting so ballistic over this issue.
Matthew.
I think, again, it has to do with a longstanding tradition of anti-government skepticism in the United States of America. People are fine, more or less, with market rationing, if that's what you want to call it. The market rations the number of flat-screen TVs. And because of market rationing, I don't have a big plasma screen TV. People get uncomfortable with the way the market can ration healthcare because people want to be healthy. At the same time, I think a lot of people are more comfortable with having millions of different decisions going on and a variety of insurance companies than they are with simply the government deciding which treatments you can or cannot get.
All right. I want to tell you that on Monday in our first hour, we will have experts, analysts in here talking about the healthcare plan, and they will be here primarily to answer your questions. That will be in the first hour. I also want to ask you, Illner, we know that Eunice Kennedy Shriver, the funeral service is being held today. The street outside of Cape Cod Church, where a private funeral mass is being held, is lined with Special Olympians. What is her legacy?
Well, the fact that all the Special Olympians have showed up. I mean, one of the members of the Kennedy family, there were nine children, and one of them was developmentally challenged and was institutionalized. I believe it was Rosemary. And Eunice felt this very deeply, and I think in 1962 started Special Olympics in her backyard, and it's grown into this global Olympic event. And I'm sure many lives have been touched positively by what she's done. And it comes in the context of a political debate where we're accusing liberals of wanting to end the lives of children with Down syndrome. And I think the Kennedy Shriver legacy, I think, refutes that.
If I could just add a sort of a personal note on her legacy, I was at Mass one day some years back, not, you know, maybe 5 years ago, with my young daughters. And right in front of us at Mass were Eunice and Sarge Shriver. And when I just said that was the ex-president's sister, that meant nothing to them. But when I told them she started the Special Olympics, they knew exactly what I was talking about, and they were quite impressed.
And the one person, sadly, who is not there is Senator Edward Kennedy. Jackie Combs, Matthew Continetti, Eleanor Cliff, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks, Diane.
Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.